Innovation Alberta, a program about science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. On this evening's program, the futuristic and the ancient. When Chris Lum stepped into the shoes of CEO, Microline was a new venture, a spin-off from a research project developed at the University of Alberta. Now, this Edmonton company is known the world over for its ability to manufacture the tiniest of instruments for both medical analysis and high-tech telecommunications. And physiologist Dr. Larry Wong has turned his attention to the ancient wisdom of Chinese herbalists. He's looking for the science behind the traditional medicines used in the Asian world for more than 5,000 years. All this coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. Talk to anybody working in the fields of micro and nanotechnology, and sooner or later you'll hear the name Microline. Microline is an Edmonton company with a very high-powered and high-tech global clientele. After all, it produces the chip of choice for researchers working on the Human Genome Project. And its tiny new switches will give birth to the next generation of telecommunications instrumentation. As CEO Chris Lum explains, at the heart of Microline's operation is its ability to do something called micromachining.
Micromachining is a very interesting and novel new emerging technology. We're talking very small. Features on our components would be in the size of microns or even submicrons. And to give you a sense of what a micron is, that's a millionth of a meter. And the width of a human hair is about 100 microns. And so we're talking about features that are so small that you can't see them. And so although the parts that we make would be perhaps, you know, up to an inch square, what really makes them unique is the specialized features that are on them that are so small that you can't see.
How do you even manufacture things that are that small?
The micromachining manufacturing has a strong connection to the semiconductor or microprocessor industry. So the computer chips that are in a computer, a telephone, a TV, a car these days are all made using using a manufacturing technology that's very similar to what we use. And if you go into our plant, the pieces of equipment that are used to make our parts are actually quite large. If you've seen pictures of a clean room, you see people wearing a white suit. They're in a clean room, a very clean room, and that's to keep dust off the parts because a piece of dust, as you can imagine, is huge compared to the size of the features that we're making. Essentially, you start with a piece of silicon or a piece of glass or some flat layer of something, and you lay down layers of metal or various other kinds of material, and then you take certain ones of those away using chemicals to etch them away. You put more on. You take more away. You might put a cover plate on top to bond it. And you essentially build up what is really like a sandwich of different features on top of this this base material that we call a substrate. And at the end of the day, you cut it all up and you have these little components and package them up and ship them off to customers.
Microline has been making a name for itself in a number of areas, and one is the connection to the Human Genome Project. What is that connection?
One of the main areas where micromachining technology is being applied is in the analysis of both DNA and proteins. The Human Genome Project was originally a large U.S. federal government project to identify the sequence of DNA in the human body. It was felt that once that was understood, that it would unlock the keys to what to a lot of the knowledge about life, how our bodies work, how disease works, how traits get passed from generation to generation. It was a huge project, and it ended up actually being completed by a private company in the end, not by the federal government. As it turns out, the private company that completed that is also one of our major customers and one of our investors as well. Now, what's happened as a result of identifying of having the Human Genome Project finished is what it's really done is just opened the door to a whole new set of biology problems that need to be addressed, and that is the issue of what does DNA actually do? How does it cause certain things to happen in the body? And that and it essentially works by causing various kinds of reactions of proteins to take place in your body, and they're tremendously complex. And understanding that is, and that whole field is becoming known as the field of proteomics. And proteomics is a very nascent field, but our technology essentially is used in both DNA analysis and protein analysis, in that the way that these analyses are done is by having massively parallel instruments that can test hundreds or thousands of compounds at a time to see how they work and how they react with each other. And to be able to do that many at once, if you can miniaturize them, you can get a significant improvement in terms of being able to do more of them at once, and being able to do them faster, and being able to use less of the very expensive compounds that you're testing. And so our micromachining technology plays a key role in that kind of analysis that is being done.
How exactly would it work?
Well, there's a variety of ways that it can work. There are a number of different kinds of instruments that can be used for DNA analysis or that can be used for protein analysis, and a number of different techniques. Some of them are called electrophoresis-based machines, and we would get into some complexity about how these machines work if we went too much further. Some of them use techniques known as mass spectroscopy, but in essence, they all revolve around getting a sample that needs to be tested. And it might be a potential drug compound. It might be some biological material that you want to diagnose. Getting it into a format where you can make it very small and get it into a machine quickly, do some analysis, and get it out. And so in many cases, the components that we make are used as front ends and back ends to these instruments to enable rapid and precise delivery of material to the machines.
How is it then that this group or this company in the States ended up coming to Microline in Edmonton, Alberta, when they could have gone anywhere in the world? Is there anyone else in the world that's doing this?
It's very interesting. It's a very interesting field. In terms of, there are lots of people working in this area in the world, and a lot of the work that's going on is going on at universities and research institutes. The University of Alberta, for example, is one of Canada's leading research universities in this area. And in fact, a lot of the capability that we developed came from our work with professors at the university. We used to be owned by the university, so we're a spin-off of the university. And in our early stages, a lot of the base technology that we developed was done with people there. And so that's one of the reasons we have the capability. And part of the reason that the professors at the university have the capability is because of us, because we had the facilities that enabled them to develop their capability. So it's worked very well together. Now, in terms of commercial companies, so there's a lot of work going on at universities, but in terms of commercial companies, there's very few companies commercially in the world that have yet managed to establish themselves. There are no others that we know of in Canada that work in this area of development and manufacturing of micromachine devices. There are maybe six or seven others in the world. Most of those are in the U.S., but there's some in Europe. And as far as we know, we're the only one right now that's profitable. And we're very pleased about that, because it perhaps says that it's still an immature industry, which it is, but it also says that from our point of view, we've taken the commercial success of our company very seriously, and we've specifically targeted market-leading customers, industry-leading instrument manufacturers as our customers. We've built up a good customer base, and we think that really validates our approach to running our business.
You've been focusing on the biological aspects of this, but are there other applications to the work that you're doing?
There are. Micromachining technology is what we call an enabling technology, in that it can have application in a variety of areas. We've chosen two areas. One is the bio area. The other area that we focus on extensively is telecommunications. Telecommunications today has a bit of a tarnish on it because of the the dot-com bomb and the drop in the technology markets over the last couple of years. However, the use of the internet and demand for bandwidth, telecom bandwidth, is still rising, and it's still rising at a very rapid rate. And even though there's a little bit of a drop in the industry right now, we have a lot of confidence in it coming back and staying a strong industry for many years. Like, the internet is here to stay, and the internet economy is here to stay, and it will come and go in different forms, and there will be booms and busts along the way. But essentially, telecommunications is a very important driver of the economy, and it's an important driver of this technology. So about half of our business is in telecom, and it's actually growing very quickly, even though there's a slowdown in the industry. And what we do is help our customers develop new products that enable data to move more quickly through telecom networks. That, you know, stated very simply, that's how it works. Now, one more level of specificity. Data moves more quickly if you can keep it in the form of light as it moves through a fiber optic network than if you have to switch it to electricity. So if you push the button on your computer, push the enter button to send an email message, say, across the country, it leaves your computer in the form of electricity, and it goes through switches, and it finally gets out somewhere into a network where it gets converted to light, gets sent to the other side of the country in a light network, and then it gets converted back into electricity to get down to the computer at the other end. Every time you switch it from light back to electricity, or the other way around, or every time you switch it, you slow the signal down. The faster you can make that signal go, the more data you can pump through the pipe. And so what a lot of telecom companies are working on is making what are known as all-optical networks or all-optical switches. And our technology enables more of the signal to stay in an optical format rather than a electrical format. So we work with industry-leading customers like JDS Uniphase, for example, and we're helping them develop really the next generation telecom network.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I was speaking with Chris Lum, CEO of the Edmonton microfabrication company, Microline. Coming up, the science behind traditional Chinese medicine. Go into any supermarket and you'll find ginseng tea sitting next to the orange pico. And down the aspirin aisle, you'll also find bottles filled with things like ginkgo and other herbal concoctions. The modern world is finally making some room for the wisdom of the ancients. And that change in perspective is thanks in part to scientists like Dr. Larry Wong. He's part of a group at the University of Alberta, which is researching the science behind traditional medicines like those used by the Chinese.
First of all, Chinese medicine is built on clinical trial and error. It's descriptive. People tried it, see if it works. If it works, we'll retain it. If it doesn't work, it kills people. Let's better forget about that one. So in other words, it's a thousands of years of clinical trial and error and the documentation. Chinese medicine is also very much emphasizing prevention than treatment. I guess it stems from the desire for emperors and the people in high places to want to live forever. So therefore, what kind of medicinal herbs, plants, whatever, that will make me, the emperor, live forever because I like my job. And so through these kind of aspirations, the herbalists of the ancient China began to classify herbs into three major categories. The imperial class, those herbs which are rejuvenating, which are preventive of diseases, ginseng, for example, reishi, or lingzi, for example. These are very, you know, typical herbs that's been around for thousands of years. And the second area will be herbs we call ministerial class. They maintain the status quo. they don't rejuvenate, but they maintain the status quo so you don't deteriorate. And, of course, we have many other examples in this category. And the third category, they call the servant class. Now, not to, you know, make any derogatory comments on jobs, but in ancient China, you know, the imperial versus ministerial versus a servant, they implied the different classes of, quote, you know, services provided to the country. So the servant class is considered to be the lowest of the three classes and usually involve herbs which are toxic. And the job of these herbs are to treat and to rectify a diseased state. So way back in over 2,000 years ago, when the first book was ever written by the Holy Farmer, it's called the Holy Farmer's Materia Medica, which synthesized another 3,000 years of experiences without written words, because written language and the paper was invented in the Han Dynasty about 25 AD. So printing and the paper and so on were available, you know, fairly recently in the Chinese history, even though the history can be, you know, traced back to 5,000 years. So that book basically set the stage for Chinese medicine to be a preventive, to be something to rejuvenate, and probably to work with the body, to let the body generate its natural defense, to fight against the germs and the viruses and the all kinds of foreign invaders. Obviously, China was not very high on the scale in terms of sanitary conditions. We all know that. And without very good sanitary conditions, without very good water, and without very good, perhaps, you know, various preventive measures for food safety and the food safety and all the raw ingredients and so on, the only defense against diseases is your own body. So how do you use your own immune system to fight against all the invasions from every corner, you know, of your everyday living? I think that speaks a lot about the impetus of Chinese medicine.
All the things that you've mentioned here, prevention of disease, so the emphasis on wellness, and things like ginseng and green tea, these are all things that 20 years ago in Western culture would have been poo-pooed, and yet now they're at the height of medical fashion, as it were. What's happening here? Why are these now becoming the sorts of things that we are willing to focus on?
I don't know the exact answer. But if I were to make a guess, I think that leads to the second point, you know, I was going to elaborate on. You know, first point, of course, is about Chinese medicine being preventive. And the second viewpoint is that, is there really a difference between Chinese medicine and the Western medicine? So you were asking me to compare that. And I'm going to say that in terms of the treatment side, in other words, if we don't look at the prevention aspect, you look at the treatment side, I think the difference is very small, if existing at all. Most people will find that very, very difficult to comprehend. Larry, you got to be joking. Western medicine is so precise. Chinese medicine is so imprecise. What do you mean there's no difference in the treatment aspect? Well, let me elaborate, perhaps. You see, as a physiologist, I began to appreciate the concept of black box physiology. And the physiology being the cornerstone of modern medicine, therefore black box physiology or pathology is very much the cornerstone of modern medicine. Now, what do I mean by black box, you know, physiology? Black box physiology refers to the relegation of an unknown, either single or series of mechanisms that either change or rectify one physiological state to another physiological state. For example, I touch you, you move. Okay? I touch you, you move. From my touching to your moving, there's a whole bunch of things changing in your physiology. From the reception of the touch of your skin receptors conducted by your nerve to your brain and to the brain scrambling that I'm touched, not pinched. And I like the touch, I'll come closer. I don't like it, I go further. In other words, a whole bunch of integration and a resolution. How many nerve cells are involved in the brain? We don't know. Where in the brain precisely? We don't know. What are the neurochemicals involved between nerve communications? We don't know. But you touch me, I move. It's absolutely predictable. So therefore, whatever's going on in the brain becomes less important in terms of the predictability of a stimulus and a response. So therefore, I can call what's in the brain the black box. But a stimulus and a response is scientifically predictable. Science is nothing about, it's no more than predictability in my mind. If I can predict the outcome of a series of events 95 out of 100 times, that's a science. So therefore, even though we don't understand the mechanism involved, doesn't deny the fact that we have a scientific approach because it's predictable.
One of the things that you've been researching is ginseng. What have you found out there? What's the scientific basis for how ginseng works?
See, ginseng has been dubbed as the imperial herb. It's the number one herb in Chinese medicine. Why? Because it's supposed to rejuvenate you. What do you mean by anti-aging? Well, keep your memory longer and perhaps keep your mental sharpness longer. Is there a scientific basis for that? So this is something we've been studying for many, many years. Many years ago at the University of Alberta, we established a traditional medicine research program with Dr. Peter Pan, who used to be the chairman of physiology. So together we started this program about 1986. And we attract, a good degree of funding. And we started looking at various problems. So my focus has been on ginseng and the memory and then working with the other scientists in the program. And to make a long story short, basically there are ingredients in the ginseng root which can help you retain short-term memory better. And we did that in animal studies. And we didn't do human studies because we cannot use a single compound. So basically we are able to isolate the pure ingredients from ginseng root to enhance short-term learning and the memory in various systems. And we published all these scientific results. And we also received actually a U.S. patent on using the ginseng ingredients, the ginsenosides, to treat Alzheimer's disease, which is a big jump, of course, with our human trials. But the mechanism involved in enhancing learning the memory, short-term learning memory, or the brain's cholinergic system is precisely that. So we're quite happy that our work was viewed with such a favor by the Patent and Trade Office. Now, more recently, we've been also working on other ingredients of ginseng for learning the memory. Now, I just want to give you perhaps a short story on this. How far we can go, I don't know, but let me give you a simple story on this because, we have only a limited time. Now, we all know that in Alzheimer, one of the major problems is the formation of a plaque in the nerve cells by a particular protein called the beta amyloid protein. So beta amyloid protein comes from our own brain cells. And when they accumulate, they form a plaque, they disrupt the communication between nerve cells. And basically, you have a circuit blocked. And therefore, you cannot complete the neural circuit for learning and the memory. So in our hands, we're able to demonstrate, if we look at, the brain cells in a totally test tube situation, we're able to demonstrate that if you add this neural plaque to, brain cells, their ability to release the neurochemical for communication is indeed hampered and indeed interrupted. But if we treat this preparation with this particular ginsenoside, we call it RG1, we can actually prevent some of the same deleterious effect that beta amyloid protein cause in the deterioration of the neural function. So in a test tube situation, we're able to demonstrate a mechanism that works at the neuronal and the nerve cell level, that a particular compound from the ginseng root can indeed overcome the known effect of a neural plaque on inhibiting neuronal function. Now, we know in our current state of knowledge on Alzheimer's disease is that the neural plaque plays a very significant role in terms of the deterioration and of the degeneration of the nervous function, especially in the, you know, in the cognitive side. We also know that in the Chinese medicine, ginseng is supposed to enhance learning, the memory, rejuvenate your brain, and keep you mentally sharp for a long time. So for the first time, we're able to have a link at the cellular level why this particular clinical observation in ancient China can be now explained based on the experiments we just completed doing.
Now, is it a question of isolating the active ingredients, or are there other things that go along with it? Do you have to have these other things within the herbs to make them work more, to work better?
Yes, I think that has been an ongoing debate even in China today, whether you use the complete formulation or you use a single compound. They both have merits. Okay, there are examples in China today, a single compound from, you know, a whole slew of herbs can represent the action of the whole decoction. But there are also other examples that if you isolate a compound, they don't work as well as the whole decoction. So therefore, I think depending on the situation that you have different answers.
Where are you heading off to today?
Today, I'm going to have lunch with one professor from the Faculty of Medicine. And we're going to be discussing the possibility of starting a human trial on one of the herbal preparations that we have some very interesting animal preclinical studies on. And I was quite fascinated by this particular product, which, you know, was provided to us as a research contract through the industrial liaison office. And I thought this particular product can perhaps help with the management of obesity, and perhaps we can do something beyond clinical trials and try them in humans to see if indeed this thing can be efficacious. And if that's the case, we have one more weapon in the arsenal to fight the major health, hazard of obesity.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Cheryl, and enjoy the conversation.
That was Dr. Larry Wong, physiologist and professor at the University of Alberta. He's also the U of A's presidential advisor on international affairs. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. Check out our website. You can listen to past programs in real audio. That's at innovationalberta.ckua.com. Technical producer for Innovation Alberta is Paul Pates. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Good night.